It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and joining me today in the studio is John McClain. For those of you who have any connection to the Forest Service or wildland firefighting, everyone knows John McClain. John is the author of a new book, The Esperanza Fire. He is also the author of three previous books on fire. The two that I know involve the 30-mile fire and Fire on the Mountain. Good morning, John. Welcome to Fed Talk.
Good morning, Deborah. Thank you for having me.
It's a real honor, and I know you have an enormous following out there in the fire community, and they're probably listening to you, and they should buy the book because it is a really great story. It's very well done. It interweaves so many aspects behind the fire and then the aftermath of the fire. It's a fascinating book. We are going to spend the next 55 minutes speaking with you, John, about the book and what got you motivated to write about this particular fire. Joining me to interview John is my good friend Tony Vernetti, who happens to be the president and founder of Federal Employee Defense Services, which is a professional liability insurer for federal employees. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Deborah and John. Thanks for letting me crash on the show
today. Yeah. Well, Tony, of course, can't miss the show because, as John knows, and many people connected with the Esperanza Fire know, Tony and I had the honor as attorneys to represent some of the fire management team, Forest Service fire management team, in the various investigations that ensued after the fire. And Tony and I, like John was there far more often, but Tony and I did actually visit the site of the Esperanza Fire with our clients. So we would never think of doing the show, Tony, without you. So welcome aboard. So John, it's your third book on fire. You have an enormous following in the Forest Service. And I think for many people, they're always surprised to hear that you started your career writing, not as a novelist about fire, but with the Chicago Tribune, where you actually spent quite a bit of your life.
30 years.
30 years mm-hmm. writing about things other than fire.
That's correct. Most of it was in Washington, D.C., here in D.C., and most of that time was as the diplomatic correspondent covering the State Department.
So you go from the State Department to wildland fire, and
right.
There had to be something that get you from, there's like two different universes if you're going to write about a topic. There's international diplomacy and there's wildland firefighting, and
right.
They are not connected.
Well, they are in me. That was my career as a journalist covering foreign policy. I wound up being the foreign editor of the Tribune for a time. But my dad came to publishing late. As I always said, by the time he became a published author with The River Runs Through It, I'd been a writer for 25 years, and he caught up in a hurry. He was ecstatic over the success of The River Runs Through It.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book.
It's a world-class literature. It really is good. And he thought he was going to write a couple more books. River Runs Through It came out when he started writing it when he was older than I am now, and I'm almost 70. And it came out when he was 73, and he thought he had enough time for a couple more books. So he started this little fire story. He was going to work on Man Gulch because he'd been there in 1949, right after the Man Gulch fire, probably the most famous fire in middle 20th century history, killed 13 men. And he got involved in it. He tried to do what I do, which is, you know, write a recreation narrative, and he couldn't do it. He was a guy who swung for the fences and got the ball over the fence, but it didn't. didn't work for him to try to have a straight narrative. And so he started struggling with the book. He worked on it for 14 years. He died with the book unpublished, but not really incomplete. There had been a full draft for a long time. So it fell to me and to the family to decide whether or not to even publish it. There was a real question about that. And I hadn't read it for 10 years. So we took it to some experts, and they said, and we took it to the University of Chicago Press, and they said,
If it's done well, if it's done well, they're riveting stories to read.
It's a great book.
They capture
book.
Your imagination.
It's another great book. I mean, he was slugging for the fences, and it was confused because it hadn't started out that way. But they had a very fine editor at the UC Press still there, Alan Thomas, and he straightened out the stuff without doing much rewriting at all. And then we all worked on it, doing the things you always do with a book, fact-checking and seeing it for internal consistency and things like that. And the UC Press kept a scorecard. And I had over 100 little things, and I got a 95% plus batting average, which was pretty good.
It's a good rating.
Yeah. So
you did
I'd,
well.
I'd done my duty by my old man. And then I took one more step. And I said, you know, if my father was alive, he would have made himself available to the people who are still around, who are connected with Mann Gulch, who are affected by the book. You know, it is the habit of third-rate reporters to write a story and do their little dirty deed and then run away and never come back for the consequences. Mm. And when I was a reporter, I tried to stay away from that. And as an author, I have been very deliberate in staying away from that. When I'm done with a book, I go back to the place where it happened, and I present myself publicly, and I'm accessible and available. And then what you hear isn't always nice, but, you know, I will listen to whatever anybody has to say.
Hmm.
Sometimes I will respond. Sometimes I won't. But I've made that a hard and fast rule. And I started it on Mann Gulch.
Hmm.
And I wrote to all these people who were still around.
This is before the book got published.
This is after it got published.
After it got published.
Yeah. I mean, these things have, the fire was, you know, 25 years old or more at that time, but they have, a book has an enormous effect on
people.
It does,
as does a news article.
Yeah.
Yeah, anything that's out there in the public domain about somebody personally.
Right, and it opens up things and wounds and cleanses, does all kinds of things. Anyway, a lot of people responded, and I met some of them, and some of them are very touching encounters. I drove over to Spokane one time from my cabin in Montana, and had lunch with the last survivor, Bob Sally. And he's a real gentleman. I mean, he's quite a figure. But another time I heard from a couple of guys who were nephews of one of the men who had been killed. And they said that their mother, the victim's brother, had never been able to talk about her brother. She had loved him dearly. They'd been very close. And after the book came out, she could do nothing but talk about it.
Oh, my goodness.
And the stories had just poured out. I mean, this is 25 years later.
Yeah.
These are grown men. One of them was by then a retired state trooper. They'd had big careers. And they were opened up as individuals. They were finding out about someone who was a blood relative that they'd never known. They decided to go back to Mann Gulch. And they did. And I said, well, you know, you're only 100 miles from my cabin. Why don't you come on over afterward and I'll buy you dinner. So they came over to the cabin, and we sat around on the porch and had dinner and talked the night away. And it obviously was a life-changing experience for them and deeply moving. So, fine, I'd done my job, duty to my father, duty to the book, duty to the people. And then the South Canyon fire came along
mm-hmm.
in 1994, and it was a mirror image of Mann Gulch. There is actually a poster that has Storm King Mountain, where the South Canyon fire happened, on one side, and the mountain, Willow Mountain, where Mann Gulch happened, on the other side. And you'd believe that they were a Rorschach test. They just, somebody slapped the ink together, and it's the same thing. And people kept telling me, well, John, you've got to do this as a book. I was working for the Tribune at the time, and I'd kind of run my career to the end. You know, 30 years in journalism was enough. And I said, well, I don't really want to do this. Following in my father's footsteps, I'm going to get creamed the first time. How'd you like to step up to the plate and say, well, everything I write is going to be compared to a river runs through it.
Right, right. That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking, for particularly for a son.
Yeah.
You know, a father and a son, and a river runs through it. It's such a beautiful story, and it's so well told. I mean, you must have felt, you know, you must have felt that there was a fence to jump over.
Well, I decided to go around the fence. I think if I had tried to write the way my father does, it would have been an utter disaster. So I said, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I'm a journalist. That's what it is. And I can write a straight narrative. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to make it as different as I can from the way my dad wrote. And it's taken me almost 20 years to get very comfortable with having done that.
Mm-hmm.
But it works for me. And I think on Esperanza Fire, it really worked.
It really worked. I would agree.
And it has taken quite a while to get there. So that's what I did. I had done enough on fire, I think, that I could have walked away from South Canyon. But I made it wasn't a mistake, but I made a move, and I called the family of Don Mackey, the smoke jumper and charger who'd been killed on South Canyon, and I became engaged with them. And was until the father just died a couple of years ago from cancer. I'm sorry to say, they were friends and still are. And it's such a good story. It happened in my backyard after a fashion. I mean, Don Mackey lived in the Bitterroot Valley in Montana. It's just 100 miles away from my cabin. He was a smoke jumper. My dad's book was about smoke jumpers. All right. So I quit the Tribune.
Well, for our listeners, where you know, in the country were these? It was South Canyon and Mango.
Oh, all right. We know that.
The Storm King Mountain is in where the South Canyon fire happened, is in just about the center of the state of Colorado. Oh. And the smoke jumpers, of course, fly around everywhere, so they are not tied down to one place or another. Don Mackey was a Missoula smoke jumper. And Missoula, of course, is in Montana and right near my cabin. But they come from different bases. They get on a plane. They're dropped on a fire. And it could be in North Carolina, and it could be in Montana, or it could be, in this case, it was in Colorado. Man Gulch, on the other hand, is in Montana. It's about 35 miles from Helena as the crow flies and is in a wilderness area. And it might as well be 1,000 miles from Helena, though you can almost see it, see the ridges around it from Helena. In fact, the ranger in charge of Man Gulch could see the smoke from Man Gulch when he was at the airport in Helena, wondering what he should do next in 1949.
Well, John, we're not done listening to how you got the bug. Because it's no doubt you read your books,
the fire
bug. You know you got the bug, and at some point I think the community around you must inspire you to write about these tragedies. But we need to stop for our first commercial break. If you just joined us, we're listening to John McClain. He is the author of the book, the newly released book, The Esperanza Fire. We'll be back momentarily to speak with John more about the book and his other books. You're listening to Fed Talk at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting your show today. With me in the studio is John McClain. He is the acclaimed author of the book, The Esperanza Fire, and of course, three other books on wildland fires, all involving our National Forest Service firefighting, wildland firefighters. John, you were explaining to us before we took the break, you were explaining to us how you made the jump from writing being a journalist for the Chicago Tribune for 30 years, and making the jump into wildland firefighting reporting or storytelling. And I didn't want to, we had to take our commercial break. So to sort of go back to where we were before our commercial, you were telling us sort of the sort of moment when you made the decision to leave the Tribune and write about the 94 fire.
Right, the 94 fire, the South Canyon fire. And I was pretty young. I was 52. I had a long working career and a couple of kids ahead of me. So I was a little concerned about what was going to happen. I headed off for Storm King Mountain on April 1st, which is April Fool's Day.
Don't take it so literally.
Yeah, I hope this doesn't affect me directly, you know. But anyway, I did the book and thought I was done with fire again, and was wrong. But these things have kept happening. They're all connected. We had the 30-mile fire next, which killed four fine young Forest Service firefighters. And despite the lessons learned on South Canyon, there are an enormous number of lessons learned on South Canyon. I mean, and they're still being integrated into the fire service. The pros do this. I don't. I don't tell people how to fight a fire. I just tell them what happened and try to raise their situational awareness and consciousness. The professional firefighters are the ones who go about it scientifically. Mm-hmm. They experiment. They try something to see if it works. If it doesn't work, they drop it and try something different. I was encouraged initially to write a chapter at the end of Fire on a Mountain saying, here's what we should do about the fighting fires. Here are the 10 things you should do.
Well, I actually thought that the last chapter of the Esperanza book, for me, somebody who had been involved in both the 30 Mile and Esperanza, representing fire management officials in these investigations, right. And maybe it was because of my perspective that I represent Forest Service firefighters, that I've represented them in these horrific investigations, because they're horrible to go through. But I've said to my colleague at work, and I said to Tony, read the last chapter of the book first, because it's you take it and you put it all. So for people who aren't involved in fire and they don't know all of the science of it, and of course there's an arson story in Esperanza, and then there's the political story, and then there's the politics of firefighting, all of it. You put it all together in the last chapter. It's very well done. Uh-huh. It is very well done. And, you know, you don't necessarily impart lessons or recommendations, but you do score some points, I thought, in the last chapter. You are making some points.
Well, good. I'm glad it came across that way, because I don't try to get very specific about, you know, how you do this. But I do try to be involved.
I can't believe they're going to try to develop 600 some houses on the side of that mountain.
Well, they, you know,
who would buy there, John? Who would buy there?
Well, more and more people pour into the wildland urban interface. I mean, what's happened since South Canyon in 1994 is that the fire service has become a lot better at fighting fires. It's a basic science. I mean, there's certain things you do, and there's only so much you can do to mitigate the danger. It's a dangerous profession, but they've gotten a lot better at it. At the same time that's happened, more and more people are pouring into the so-called wildland urban interface. They're buying houses out there. You say, how can they sell 600 new houses in an area where they had the Esperanza fire? And the answer is, easily, through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and it'll happen. And some of the people who've been out there for 25 years get it. They understand what should happen. Early evacuation, mitigation around the place, you know, clearing away debris, all the rest of it. New people come out there and they say, I just retired. You know, I haven't been following this story. I want to see something green.
Right,
I don't
and they're not personally connected to the
tragedy.
And
I don't
want to
leave fast if trouble happens. I mean, the simplest, best thing that could happen all over the country to prevent deaths in wildland fires is early evacuation. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, how do you prevent deaths in a flash flood? Get to the high ground. It's very simple lessons. Mm-hmm. But trying to get that across to people is sometimes impossible.
Well, that wasn't necessarily the case in 30 Mile, except for the civilians who were out hiking and weren't even aware that there a fire had started.
And were not injured.
That's right. Well, they weren't injured because of the heroism, as Tony reminds me.
But if you remember, there was
heroism
another
of the
fire
of the
going
firefighters.
On at the same time. That was right in the community.
Right.
You know,
it took John, all the attention.
John, you talked about how you know these three fires: South Canyon, 30 Mile, and Esperanza, and your decision to. I would like for you to comment a little more about your decision to write about them. You know, and why them? I mean, there mm-hmm. are horrific fires, you know, that happen each year, as we all know. And you mentioned how they're, in your view, intertwined, interrelated, and kind of tell, you know, a more complete narrative. I was wondering if you can sort of explain and comment on that a little bit more.
Well, I do have certain criteria, but they're fairly flexible criteria, but when I decide whether or not to write about a story, because I've decided not to write about a lot of fires, first of all, you have to have a fairly high number of deaths. I'm sorry, but that's what I write about. Secondly, it
but
has
why is
to be,
that? Why is
well,
that?
Because that's what people read about. That's how you know you can identify with these fine young people who
that's
go
right.
out there and they're brave. They're like right. you wish you were when you were
yeah.
young.
Let me help
maybe
you.
Maybe like your kids.
Right, John. Let me help you out.
Happens.
You write about these people. The story is in those people
exactly.
and their lives.
Exactly.
And when you read your. You know, particularly because it's fresh in my mind. I just read Esperanza, the Esperanza Fire. When you read about it, I actually know some of those people that the story revolves around. They were my clients, obviously not the men who died. But you write about where there's deaths because you're writing about people and their personal stories and how they ended up there and what happened to them. And people care about that.
Well, it's also a way to honor their service and their sacrifice.
That's correct.
You know,
so by making them people so that you can see them in three dimensions and identify with them and not forget them.
Yeah, that's criteria one.
Right. You have to have a natural event that's interesting. It can't just be... I've never written a story about the air... attack people. And I've been encouraged to do it over and over again. I tell them, look, guys, you know, you guys are interesting. They're great people. They're kind of like smoke jumpers. They're all individuals.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but the trouble is, you know, I was flying along one day in a clear blue sky when
into the
and
side
that's
of the, mountain.
The end of it.
Right.
You know, I need a little buildup here. Nothing personal about this, but you've got to have a natural event that has some depth to it. You
mm-hmm.
know, I've got to write 100 pages about the fire. So that's another practical consideration. And then there's kind of a soul consideration. What attracted me most, I think, to Fire on the Mountain, to the South Canyon Fire, is that the smoke jumper in charge, Don Mackey, was being blamed for killing everybody. And he didn't deserve that. He was put in an impossible position and did his level best with it. And it wasn't good enough. Events overtook him. And I became, in a way, his defender. I haven't taken on that role so much with Esperanza because I didn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was one guy stood up at a book event of mine a couple of months ago, and he's a longtime Forest Service guy, 25, 30 years in the Forest. He says, you know what you've done? I said, no, I don't know what I've done. He said, you've made it impossible for these official investigations to kiss off the deaths by saying, well, they did it to themselves. You know, they can't do that anymore. There are times with fires where somebody did something that caused their own death. I haven't written about those. I'm not going to write about them because that's the way it went.
Well, they tried to do that in 30 Mile Fire.
They
well,
tried
they did.
Harder than they have ever tried before
well, they,
in 30 Mile Fire.
But they didn't try,
fire,
they did.
And they did it.
They
and
did.
And blew up in their faces.
Right.
And it
right.
has caused, it's created a whole legal industry of which you're a part. it's probably
they need a defense
the biggest
too.
Mistake they've ever made. I mean, they blamed the people who died for refusing an order that would have saved their lives, for hearing, nodding in acknowledgement, and refusing the order to come down out of those rocks, an act that would indeed have saved
it
their
would have
lives.
Saved their lives.
And in fact, that isn't what happened.
But there's a similarity in Esperanza because you tell in the middle of the story, and we need to eventually get into the Esperanza fire, but there is that similarity where the IC, you know, makes his way down to the Octagon House and, you know, sees the captain of Engine 57, and there is a debate in many, a debate.
There's a conversation of some sort.
Well, there's varying account, there's varying descriptions by different investigative reports about what happened in that conversation, about whether or not they were given an order or a very strong suggestion to retreat back to the double wide.
Right.
One of the investigations makes a lot about it as if they had disobeyed the order, and if they had obeyed the order, they would be alive today. Clearly, if they had retreated to the double wide, they might be alive. And you say that. You don't say would have been. You said probably would be alive. Because it was very precarious at the tile house. And Tony and I remember that being there and watching from the different vistas, standing at the double wide, standing at the tile house, standing at the octagon house. It was very precarious wherever you were at 7 a.m.
That's right. Do it in orderly fashion. Let's deal with 30 miles.
You know, but before we do that, we're taking our mid-show break. But we're about to get into the heart of what people really are tuning in to listen to, which they want to talk about these fires and what you've sort of the stories that you tell of them. But we need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Geico's famous for saving people money on car insurance, and now if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I'm co-hosting the show this morning with my colleague and good friend Tony Vernetti. Tony and I were both involved in representing fire management officials in the 30 Mile Fire and in the Esperanza Fire, and we're here to interview today John McClain, who is the author of his latest book on wildland fires, and it's the Esperanza Fire, which is a story about arson, murder, and the agony of Engine 57. And we were sort of getting into the middle of the story, John, without really talking about it from the front end. Of all the fires you've written about, this one was maliciously started.
That's correct. It was started by an arsonist.
Yeah. What I was pleased to see in your book was at the very beginning up front, you talk about the culture of arson, the almost accepted culture of arson in Southern California, which I'm a girl from the Northeast, and there's no culture of arson in the Northeast. Arson is bad. It's viewed as bad. It's not sport. And Tony and I remember Tony going out there to meet up with our clients at the Esperanza Fire. It's the first time we encountered this concept that arson, there's some acceptability to setting fires.
It had an acceptability until recent times because it was a way of clearing brush. It was a way of making jobs. People were unhappy with put out all fires on site. You know, they wanted to do it the way Grandpa always did it, which is to burn the stuff in the fall so that you have a good growth for grazing in the spring. And that all got stopped in the 20th century, and people were very unhappy about it. So that if you lit a fire in the backcountry to clear brush, or if you were a fire manager and you did it to make work for your crew or to clean out some nasty little patch, that's what people did. That's no longer accepted. Mm-hmm. It is not accepted by the community. It's not accepted by the law. And the Esperanza Fire is the example of what can happen to somebody who sets a fire. It is an
He wasn't setting a fire for land use management reasons.
He was a serial arsonist who had set maybe 80 fires that summer. He was charged with over 20. The success rate for an arsonist, we are told by arsonists themselves, is about 50%. You know, not everyone you set goes off. So if you take the ones he did set and double it, you can get close to 100.
How did he set the fire for the Esperanza Fire? And we're talking about Raymond Euler.
That's right.
You know, we should give him a name.
Give him a name? Yeah.
You're actually his pen pal.
I am in touch with him. I have a correspondence with Raymond. He is on death row in San Quentin State Prison. And
because he was convicted for
and that's a huge part of the story. I mean, not only was he prosecuted for murder, for arson, which is a big deal, but, you know, he got the death penalty as well.
The prosecution for murder is the first time anybody has ever been found guilty of murder for setting a wildland fire. They've come close in the past,
right.
but it has not happened. It became a precedent very quickly that was used. There was an additional case 6 months later where Ricky Lee Fowler in a neighboring county in San Bernardino County was charged with starting the Old Fire in 2003, which killed six people, most of them by heart attack. So it was a tendentious prosecution. It was also a successful prosecution. I should say the prosecutor says, no, it didn't have anything to do with Raymond Euler. Well, okay, that's what he says. Earlier this year,
but the jury pool clearly began to accept the concept. That's your point, is they began to accept the concept that somebody could be held criminally directly liable for the deaths that may occur hours or days later because of a fire you started.
And they got by the kind of indirect causation.
Well done, Deborah. Yeah, I wish I could have said that.
But that's what your point is that the jury pool, he realized the jury pool, because I don't know that we've said this, but the Esperanza Fire is in the San Bernardino National Forest, which is Southern California. It's about, 45 minutes north of Palm Springs and about an hour and a half or 2 hours
east of L.A.
Of L.A.
Yeah, it's what you go through.
That's right.
On your way from L.A. to the desert communities like Palm Springs. You don't stop because it's small, generally blue-collar towns and precipitous sides to the thing. It's the deepest canyon, east-west canyon in California, and has long been a trade route. But it's chaparral. It's kind of desert country. You get up in the mountains, and it's all nice and piney.
And, of course, that topography, what you just described, is even people on the East Coast know what have heard of the Santa Ana winds. And for Raymond Euler, those fires he set, he was counting on them. And that's
he came to count on them. He was
right.
On a learning curve. And that's what
right.
The prosecution had to show. And it was very difficult to show that he'd started in May with very small fires along a roadway, basically stopping his car and dropping something out the window or just stepping outside and putting a cigarette with matches wrapped around it by a rubber band.
Lit cigarette.
A lit cigarette. And to light a cigarette, you have to put it in your mouth and puff on it. Remember that as the story goes along. So they were very small fires, like the size of a hat or a quarter acre. But the arson investigators realized immediately when they had three fires on May 16th close to each other that they had a serial arsonist. And these guys don't stop until they're caught or they leave the area or die. And in fact, they were having small fires all summer long, but they were getting bigger and they were becoming more worrisome because whoever was setting them was discovering that slope magnifies the effect of a fire. That if you get it into really nice, thick, flashy fuels, that it'll have a better chance of taking off. And so there was a learning curve. Getting an education. And he also discovered he didn't have to have 16 zillion matches around the cigarette. You know, just a couple, three, four, five would be enough. And that came out during the trial, that there was a clear evolutionary progression in these things. They were becoming more effective. They were becoming simpler. Somebody was learning a lot, and they were connected. There is no absolute evidence tying Raymond Euler.
There is none.
To the Esperanza Fire arson device, which was recovered. There is absolute evidence, tying him to previous ones, DNA evidence from the filter tips of the Marlboro cigarettes that he used. And that's what brought him in. He was caught, and speaking of precedents, I don't know if it's a precedent, he was caught within 6 days, which doesn't happen with arsonists. I mean, arsonists leave the device and leave the area. And so they're gone 10 or 15 minutes.
But in all fairness, they've been, the fire investigators from Cal Fire had been investigating him for many months and many fires.
They had not been investigating him personally. They had been investigating each fire, and they'd done a brilliant job of collecting evidence, which never got to the point of going to the crime lab because there wasn't enough damage. But they would collect these little devices. They went around to all the engine companies, and they said, guys, we've got a serial arsonist loose. We can't tell you anything more. But be very careful with the POI, the point of origin. Don't walk over it. Don't hose it. Don't drive your engine over
it. Don't step on it.
Don't step on it. And the guys complied. One of the investigators, Andy Bennett, who became the first incident commander on the fire, bought these turkey roasters, these aluminum turkey roasters, and handed them out so that when they found what was the point of origin, they would put the turkey roaster over it. And Cal Fire did this great job of collecting this stuff, which is what made the case, helped make the case. So that when they finally got to the Esperanza fire and discovered that these things were connected, they had the connective physical material so they could go back and start checking for DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they found them.
Is that why I was always wondering why the case was prosecuted on a local level, state and local, and not a federal level, because you had federal employees.
That's correct.
Who died is because they had a previous investigation ongoing?
Is it? No, it is because you had an enlightened FBI special agent in Los Angeles who decided to allow the state to proceed.
Take the lead.
This thing, when you get five local firefighters killed in Southern California, it's not an everyday event.
Mm.
It is an event that involves the entire community because those people live with fire.
But they were federal officials, as Tony points out.
Well, they're federal officials, but they were loved by the state and loved by the local people. The local guys were all over it. Cal Fire has a huge arson investigation team, about 50 guys. The Forest Service is no slouch in this. The Riverside County Sheriff's Office was the one that broke the case. There was one detective, Scott Michaels.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I find that, that's, fascinating. Like, it's a new day on arson. You like to talk about, my favorite quote in the book is from Mike Dietrich, where he talks about it's domestic terrorism.
Arson.
But as far as making this case, I mean, that's a
he figured it out.
Story.
He figured it out. That guy was a whip, man.
Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't give up.
The morning of the fatalities happened about 7:15 after the fire had progressed all night. It was started about 1 o'clock in the morning. It became a murder case, and the entire Riverside County homicide unit was sent over to begin their investigation. They were very frustrated because they couldn't get up to the site where the murders had happened because there was still fire there. One of the detectives, Scott Michaels, kept asking the Cal Fire guys, he said, what do you got that we can get started on here? Give us something to work with. He said, well, actually, we got a list of a bunch of license plate numbers from a fire that happened a couple of days ago. We had a surveillance camera, and we saw the surveillance camera took a picture of this car going into an area. It comes out, and 6 or 7 minutes later, pew, there was a column of smoke. So we figured he was good for it. We couldn't see who was in driving the car, but we've got the license number. Well, have you traced the number? Well, no, we haven't because it's, we just got it. It takes time to get it down from the pole camera, and we didn't. Well, give me the number.
And so he took the number. The detective.
The detective.
Yeah.
My guy, Scott Michaels.
Yeah, he's great.
And so he got the number, and by the time they found out that it was traced to an auto salvage shop, it was too late in the day to go there. So the next morning, frustration building, Scott and his partner go off to check this thing out. And the auto salvage guy, oh, yeah, I remember that car. I bought it for $50 in the morning, and I sold it for $100 in the afternoon to an employee, whom I later fired because he was stealing from me. Well, who's that? Oh, a guy named Ray. He got another job around here somewhere at another auto shop. Where? Oh, at the Highland Springs Auto Shop. Where is that? So they go over there, and there's
the car
with the same license number on it. And there's a guy in the back sleeping. They figured, oh boy, we got him.
He's sleeping in the car.
Yeah, story over. So they hauled him out, and he could explain himself. He was a friend of Ray Oiler's, and they had this relationship where Ray didn't mind him sleeping in the back of his car when he felt like it. So you know what kind of people you're dealing with. And while this is going on, the guys at the auto shop are waving a telephone at the cops. I mean, they're in soft clothes, but they look like cops. And it's Ray on the other end of the phone. What are you doing with my car? Well, you know, we're police officers, and we've got some questions about it, Ray. It's connected to something that happened a long time ago. Can we come and talk to you? Yeah, okay. So he gave him his address, and it was a few blocks away. Scott and his partner go over there, and Raymond Oiler opens the door of his apartment. And when he opened the door, he had his sleeves rolled up, and Scott looked at him and said, this is the guy. He had black and red flame tattoos on, full sleeve tattoos that go all the way up his arms with death heads and stuff like that. And in the background, in this dark, clammy-looking apartment, he sees a poster on a wall of a skeleton with flames coming out of its head. And it's just too weird.
So and, Scott, he's smoking Marlboros. No, I'm joking.
Well, actually, that's correct.
That's right.
Deborah, there's a big pot of cigarette butts out on the landing. Obviously, the woman he lived with wouldn't let him smoke inside. There are over 30 Marlboro cigarette butts. So, ding, ding, ding.
He also had this kind of out-of-body, sixth-sense experience.
Scott Michaels had a very real spiritual experience.
This was the guy.
How do you test a spiritual experience? Does it have an objective correlative in the real world? Does it last? Does it fade off in a couple of, he felt then and has felt ever since that the firefighters were there telling him that this was the guy. Now, this sounds really weird, but it worked, and it's very real. This
but guy, we're talking like 2 days after their death.
That's right.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I'm a believer. I think you would feel, I think you might feel their souls.
He certainly felt it.
He felt it.
There is no question about that. It directed his activities. It made him brave. He did things that he would not have done otherwise. He wound up in yelling matches with his superiors who didn't believe any of this stuff. But he also took in Raymond Oiler to the cop station and interrogated him and had him on the verge of confession. At which point he tried a ruse, which is another word for a lie, and told Raymond that his tire marks had been found at the Esperanza fire site, at which point I've got the transcript of the interview, and you can just see Raymond perking up. He's, whoa, what do you mean? I want to get out of here. No, you're wrong about that. And he was wrong about it. There was a different car that was used. But in the course of that interrogation, and it wasn't an interrogation, it was an interview. He was not compelled. He got Euler's DNA. And Euler did not agree to a polygraph, but he did agree to the swab. And that's what finally provided the link.
So he voluntarily agreed to give a DNA sample.
Yeah, and the law in California is such that they were not collecting DNA from felons at the time when Raymond had been nailed on previous drug charges.
And they were able to link that to the cigarettes that he had put in his mouth.
Well, what happened was that Scott wound up in a lot of trouble because he kept pushing this guy. He said, this is it. And his superiors were saying, no, it's not. We've got all these 250 leads on Esperanza. This other fire happened days earlier. Get off it, Scott. Pick up a couple of lead sheets and do your job. And so the fire happened on a Thursday, and the next Tuesday, Scott was at a meeting at a cramped little room where there was the FBI and ATF and everybody else, and everybody was mad at everybody because their leads were petering out, and they didn't know where to go with the thing. And his cell phone went off. And so he said, hello, guess what? And he said, I got to talk to you, Scott. I'm in a meeting. Hold on. So he went out in the hallway and flipped on his cell phone. And the woman said, this is so-and-so from the crime lab. We have two hits on Raymond Oiler for the DNA for fires that were set by the Banning Pass arsonist in June. And he said, well, you remember what you just said. And when I tell you to say it again, you say it. He said, I'm going to put you on hold. So he walked back into the meeting, puts his cell phone in the middle of the table, tells everybody to shut up. And the quote is even better than that in the book. And flips on his cell phone, and she says it, and Raymond Oyler was in handcuffs by 5 o'clock that night. It was a brilliantly intuitive arrest that was backed up by all this careful stuff
was
done by everybody else.
And great intuition. I want to bring that all full circle to something I remember reading at the end of the book, but I want to do it after our commercial break. We have to take our last commercial break. You're listening to John McClane, the author of The Esperons of Fire, tell you a little bit about what's inside his book. This is Fed Talk at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm co-hosting today's show with my colleague and friend, Tony Vernetti. We're here interviewing John McClane, the author of The Esperons of Fire. For those of you who are listening, you know John is the author of several other books that involved tragedies, Forest Service, wildland firefighters. His latest book is The Esperons of Fire. And John, before we took our commercial break, you were telling us one of those great moments in the book where the arsonist, or the he's convicted now, but at the time he was the suspected arsonist, was arrested. And what's interesting, it's not interesting, it's a great anecdote story, part of the story about this detective who within days of the fire arrested the man who was eventually convicted of not only the arson, but the murders of the firefighters at the time, Engine 57. He never visits the fire site and to make the arrest or post-arrest, but he does 5 years later.
I took him up there.
Tell us about that.
For his first visit there. Yeah.
Five years after and post-conviction is the first time he goes up there.
That's right. He'd never been up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he should be, and he wasn't eager. He kind of went along. And so we got there, and the owner of the Octagon, Greg Collar, was there. Greg's a wonderful guy, and working on the place, as he does a lot. And so we talked to him for a while. And then finally Scott went off on his own. And you have to understand, the Octagon is on a little plateau. It's like a medieval fortress sticking out over the Banning Pass. And you can see forever over the Banning Pass. It's really a spectacular view. And Scott went off just by himself for 10, 15 minutes. And Greg and I finished up and we left. And we're driving back down the mountain. I said, well, Scott, what was that like? And he said, well, he said, he'd been very pensive. He said, I understood a lot. He said, as I looked down over the side, I could see all the way to Raymond Euler's apartment. It didn't take much of a stretch of the imagination. He said, and you know, I felt the presence of the firefighters, of the dead guys, the dead men, kind of on my shoulder when I was interviewing Raymond. And I felt them pressing me and telling me, this is the guy. This is the guy. And he said, I could understand that they had a clear line
from
the Octagon down to where I was standing at Raymond's apartment. And we just kind of left it there. I mean, that's...
It's just... you don't know that until the very end of the book, that it is a clear shot line from the Octagon House, right, where they died, where they perished, to Raymond Euler's apartment, where he must have been, in my opinion, must have been watching the fire from the ground, looking up as it exploded, the instant ignition. Tony is right, though. We need to talk a little. You have about 4 minutes left. We need to talk a little about the men of Engine 57. We need to hear their names. and at least recognize the ultimate sacrifice they did make for saving, you know, people's property.
That was Captain Mark Lausenheiser, Jason McKay. Jess McLean, Pablo Cerda, and Daniel Hoover Nahara.
Yeah. And if you, if for people who are listening, and you read the book, John devotes a beautiful amount of time in the book to each one of these men. The two of us are about to, like, I don't think you're supposed to get emotional on radio. I don't think we're supposed to do that.
Well, I wasn't emotional. I was just coughing.
Right. But each one of them, he spends pages and pages and pages telling the reader who they are, how they came to fire, and how they came to the fire that evening. And they left behind, each of them left behind really loving families who to this day, every anniversary of the fire, visit the Octagon House, and there's a memorial service.
Well, actually, most of the families get together once a month. They have hung together more than any of the family groups on the other fires, partly because
they live together.
near each other, partly because this community of Idlewild, where some of them lived, is a compelling community. It's a real family, and they draw people in, and you're part of the family, and it's not what we usually think of as California. It's what you think of as an old-fashioned small town where everybody helps everybody else.
It's certainly not what you think of Southern California.
No.
Maybe Northern California, but not Southern.
Yes, right.
Right?
Let's give Northern California
a shout-out.
As well as Southern California.
It's our shout-out to Northern California here on Fed Talk.
John, I wonder, in a few minutes that we have left, if you could just talk a little bit about what happened in the fire, this thing, this concept called area ignition.
Well, they were caught by a natural event, and if absent that, they would have survived. They would have had a hard time where they were. They're down on an exposed face defending a house, which is what you do in Southern California. That's their job, and as many people have said, that will happen again. You'll go down there on an exposed spot where you really would rather not be and defend it. So they set up, had a drainage right below them that was straight drainage down to the bottom of the pass. Fire collected there and was suppressed by either an inversion or by just smoke coming over it. When the Santa Ana wind came in to the Banning Pass about 7 o'clock in the morning, it ran into this gulch and there was an area ignition, which is instantaneous fire, and it swept the site. There is moving footage of that, moving in several different ways.
Yeah.
Of it actually happening. It was observed from
I like
a half
it. It's
mile
a turning
away.
On a propane tank and letting it run for an hour and then drop a match in there.
Right. Exactly. That's a good description of it. And that's what got them. There were people nearby, just a few hundred yards away, who were protected by a couple of knolls, land bumps. And so they didn't get it as badly, but they got.
Incredibly precarious for everyone.
Yeah, it was a real rough time. And people who were 800 yards above them on a direct line experienced the same thing, except for the intensity. So it isn't as though they were stupid. They were doing their jobs. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And not a rare, but an unpredictable event occurred, an area ignition, and that's what killed them.
So in our last 30 seconds, John, your book is for sale. How do people go and buy your book?
You can buy it at your independent bookstore. You can buy it on Amazon.com, the nation's largest bookseller, or you can buy it directly from me and get an autographed copy at johnmcleanbooks.com. All you have to do is figure out how to spell my last name.
And so for those of you who don't know how to spell his last name, it's M-A-C-L-E-A-N. John McLean, thank you very much for being on our show, the author of the very acclaimed book, The Esperanza Fire and the 30-Mile Fire, which is very close to my heart. Thank you very much for being a guest, and I'm hoping we don't need to see each other again.
I hope so, too.